Hello listeners, it's Emma again. Welcome back to part two of our interview with Dr. Jabron Kokar. In today's episode, we are going to explore the topics of adolescent nicotine use and its effect on the developing brain, as well as co-occurring disorders and how they impact individuals. With the invention and widespread use of e-cigarettes, nicotine use in adolescents has become much more prevalent in North America. According to the CDC, tobacco product use is started and established primarily during adolescence, with nearly 9 out of 10 adults who smoke cigarettes daily first trying smoking by the age of 18. The increased nicotine use in adolescence is concerning for many reasons. One of these reasons includes concerns regarding the effect of nicotine on the developing brain. Would you be able to speak a bit on how nicotine exposure in adolescence affects their developing brain?
I think, you know, it's important to dispel any myths about nicotine being the cancer-causing substance in cigarette smoke. It's not. It is pharmacologically active, and it acts on those nicotinic acetylcholine receptors that I mentioned earlier, some of which are going through considerable changes during this period of adolescence. And so those changes in the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors essentially end up being the prism through which the light of exogenous nicotine, be it in the form of combustible cigarettes or vaping, sort of passes through and then gets refracted in terms of the various consequences that might happen on brain development and function. And so I think there is considerable evidence that would suggest that it does impact the function of the brain, from frontal cortical neurotransmission to behavioral outcomes, as far as cognition is concerned, as far as increased impulsivity is concerned, as far as even there's some strong evidence suggesting that exposure to nicotine during adolescence actually then makes you more vulnerable for continued use of both nicotine and other drugs. And this is in studies from animals. In our own hands, we've looked at exposure to nicotine vapor when we see that not only are we seeing long-term effects as far as the functional connectivity of the brain is concerned after exposure during adolescence, but in addition to that, we see behavioral effects as well, that animals are a shift from being, you know, start to attribute more salience to reward cues, or they now sort of shift to showing more of these sign-tracking phenotypes. And so that's some of the work we have done with nicotine. But then others have looked at it both with injected nicotine and now people looking at it with vaporized nicotine exposure as well, that though there are sort of those long-term effects across multiple domains, ranging from the function of the circuit, the electrophysiological properties of the neurons in those circuits, especially those corticostriatal circuits. And then on top of that, just the functional connectivity of those circuits.
Building off of that, are there certain routes of exposure, such as vaping, cigarettes, nicotine patches, that are worse in terms of nicotine exposure compared to others? And specifically regarding vaping or e-cigarette use, I know that sometimes they can have additional substances added into them, such as flavoring components. Are these differences considered when studying different methods of ingesting nicotine?
So in fact, when we do our exposures, we actually maintain the flavorant component as well. We actually have been using exactly what the adolescents have been using. So Juul e-cigarettes and Juul pods that are made by Juul, we have been using those in our studies to ensure that we are capturing, because, you know, otherwise, if we're just using pure nicotine, what's the difference between the, yes, there's a difference in terms of the route of administration, but what's the difference between that and the all the studies, the hundreds of studies that have been done with injected nicotine, right? So we've been actually trying to stay closer to what the exposure looks like in the humans and using exactly the pods that are being used by people who vape. As far as cancer, we don't really know about the effect or the relationship between vaping and cancer. If anything, vaping is a whole lot safer Then cigarette smoke. Cigarette smoke has those tobacco-specific nitrosamines. In the case of vaping, this is usually synthetic nicotine, and so it's not even coming from tobacco. But in addition to that, the other piece of it is that those tobacco-specific nitrosamines have also not gone through the burning process, which actually then also contributes to some of that harm. While vaping is a whole lot safer for somebody who is a smoker, because smoking remains the single largest preventable cause of death worldwide, vaping in adolescents who may have not become smokers otherwise, right? Like, it has been associated with conversion to combustible cigarette smoking or cannabis use. So this is the balance, right? Like, while on one hand, it is a harm reduction approach. It reduces harm for patients who are smoking or individuals who are smoking. On the other hand, it may be contributing to harm in individuals that may have never smoked otherwise and have now just gotten into it because they started with vaping. And maybe it was the flavors, maybe it was how socially prevalent it is that then got them to vape. And then, because nicotine is nicotine and remains the primary psychoactive and addictive component in cigarette smoke and nicotine vapor, it did what it did, and now they can't stop. Because it's relatively new, we haven't had a chance to look at directly comparing plasma levels of nicotine between vapers and smokers. Some animal studies that have looked at it, they've compared a Juul e-cigarette to a Marlboro cigarette and shown, 6 to 8 times higher levels of nicotine, especially with these salt and nicotine salt-based devices that actually reduce the irritability and make it easier for you to take more. But the other big difference, I think, that exists between cigarettes and e-cigarettes is that with a cigarette, you had a unit. So you had a cigarette, or you had, however many cigarettes in a pack, and you would light that up, and that's what you would sort of finish, right? And then your smoke break would be done and you'd be back inside. And not just that, but the FDA required cigarette manufacturers to include irritants in those cigarettes. Then when you inhaled, it would irritate your throat and you wouldn't be able to inhale as deeply, or accelerants in that cigarette so that it would burn faster. And so you would get through that cigarette and then you'd go back to whatever it was you were doing. With vaping, that's not the case. You don't have a unit. It's available, accessible, on demand whenever you want. And so you might be seeing a more continuous exposure to nicotine instead of that intermittent exposure where you would take the cigarette, it would get your nicotine levels up, and then you would wait for it to come down, and then you would go back for your next one. So I think those are some of those differences between the two forms of exposure.
The coexistence of both a mental illness and a substance use disorder is together referred to as a co-occurring disorder. Individuals who have a mental illness are more likely to experience a substance use disorder than those not affected by mental illness. In fact, according to the 2021 National Survey on Drug Use and Health in the United States, approximately 9.2 million adults have a co-occurring disorder. In terms of co-occurring disorders, does the field currently know which disorder occurs first? So, for example, does having a mental illness increase your likelihood of developing a substance use disorder, or does having a substance use disorder increase your likelihood of developing a mental illness?
Yeah, so that's kind of a lot of the research that we do in the lab is related to that chicken or egg question specifically. I don't think we have an answer to that chicken or egg question. In fact, it's probably a chicken and egg question, if we're being totally honest. Because on one hand, we do know that adolescent exposure to drugs, and we've seen this in animal models, does increase the risk for psychopathology later on in life. On the other hand, there is a causal impact of risk for genetic risk for schizophrenia, for example, on the genetic risk for lifetime cannabis use. And so somebody who is at risk for schizophrenia is actually more likely to use cannabis, and then that might have its own effects on further exacerbating or acting as that second hit. So I think it's probably a bi-directional relationship. But in terms of temporal order, one does come before the other just because that's when it normally happens. Substance use tends to happen, you know, anywhere between 13 to 15 years of age, whereas schizophrenia happens in males at around 18 to 21, 21 to 23 in females, maybe, you know, and that's where people end up being like, oh, it is a unidirectional relationship, but that's just because those things happen at those times does not mean that one came before the other and contributed to the other. And I think that's an important consideration. But I think there is known impact of the risk for psychiatric illness in making individuals more likely to use substances and vice versa as well. And then you add on top of that, that the adolescent exposure to drugs then make somebody more likely to use substances later on in life. And so maybe, you know, they were going to be diagnosed with schizophrenia anyways, but that substance use during adolescence not only exacerbated the schizophrenia piece, but also made them more likely to continue using substances later. So I think multiple factors contribute to the co-occurrence.
Expanding on that, in individuals who have co-occurring disorders, is it best to treat each condition independently and target one disorder at a time? Or has research found that treatments and therapy should be aimed at correcting both disorders simultaneously?
Yeah, no, I think that there is no consensus in the field for sure. And in fact, for a long time, you know, especially because of the self-medication hypothesis and others, there was a thought that, okay, we'll just let them use their drugs and we'll work on managing the psychiatric condition. In fact, on the, you know, psychiatric wards, you had cigarettes freely available. And so there was that thinking. But I think it's important as more and more evidence comes out that it needs an integrated approach where both the substance use and the psychiatric illness are being addressed at the same time, largely because substance use or continued substance use in those with psychiatric illness is actually associated with a significant worsening of the psychiatric disorder. The treatment non-compliance, which already is an issue in patients. On top of that, you have increased risk for violence, increased risk for hospitalizations, increased risk for suicide. And suicide, substance use in serious mental illness is actually one of the biggest predictors of suicide. And suicide remains one of the largest reasons for morbidity and mortality in patients with serious mental illness. And contributes to that lower life expectancy, which is anywhere between 15 to 20 years shorter in these patients. So I think an integrated approach is really important because in some ways that continued substance use can significantly worsen that course of the disease itself.
Where do you see these research fields going in the future? Are researchers aiming to characterize the pathophysiology of the co-occurring disorders first? Are there currently any treatment studies in the works that you know of?
We're hoping to continue characterizing that and try to understand what those neural circuits are and then either intervene pharmacologically or with neuromodulation or to change the activity of those circuits to see if we can maybe prevent the progression into a substance use disorder or reduce at least the negative impact of it on the brain circuitry. The other thing I think that we're really trying to do as far as where the research field is going in the future is maybe encouraging more researchers to pay attention to this, right? Like, as I was saying earlier, that co-occurring substance use or co-use of substances is the rule and not the exception. Oftentimes, co-occurring disorders is also the rule and not the exception. But because we study them in silos, we may miss out on important findings. So I think, and so there's maybe a case against purity when it comes to our populations that we study, or even the clinical trials that happen, because the clinical trials will happen in a perfectly curated, manicured, homogenous population, and then the drug will get approved, like varenicline, for example, and then you'll get a black box warning on it, right? Because it wasn't actually tested in the population that it's going to impact the most. And so I think there's a real need for us to advocate for the that while you can understand that the pharmaceutical company may want that perfect population to get the biggest signal, to get the drug to market, it's not actually representative of the population that you're hoping to treat. And so at the very least, as we are now having the discussions around, oh, the diversity in those populations, you know, when it comes to gender or race, I think the other important piece is those populations that we do test drugs in should be representative of the population that you're hoping to treat and not be the exactly the exclusion criteria that, you know, if you have a co-occurring psychiatric illness, you're not going to be in the trial. So if you're not in the trial, what hope do you ever have of receiving treatment? And so I think that's an important sort of soapbox that hopefully I can end on today that the future clinicians can take on.
That was so great. Thank you so much, Dr. Kokar, for coming on the podcast and sharing your knowledge with us. And with that, that concludes this episode of Hashtag Health. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please consider giving us a rating or a review and subscribing to our show. You can also follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Hashtag Health Podcast or like us on Facebook. We hope you enjoyed this episode and we can't wait for you to check out more of our podcasts. My name is Emma, and thank you so much for listening to Hashtag Health.